Welcome to this week's edition of the Casual Shooters Podcast, your premier podcast for the casual shooter. This week's guest is a young one. He's a 19-year-old young man, comes by way of Area 2. He's a full-time college student, dating arguably the best female shooter in the U.S. right now. He's also a private pilot, airplane pilot, shoots USPSA practical shooting, as well as carbine. He does quite a bit for being a 19-year-old man. So with that, join me in welcoming to the show, Mr. Carson Herding.
How are you?
Good. How are you, Carson?
Doing well.
Hope I was fairly accurate with your intro.
Yes, very accurate. Busy.
Okay. Yeah, very, very busy. Okay. If you would, go ahead and take a moment and introduce yourself.
So my name is Carson Herding. I'm 19 years old, based out of Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm a full-time college student as well as a private pilot and rescue diver. A couple other things about me as I'm a carry optics masterclass shooter. That's my primary division. I'm also an Eagle Scout, and I got that in 2019. And I'm dabbling in a little bit of carbine this year with some more information later to come.
All right, that's ridiculous. You've already done more at 19 than most people do in their whole life. You're an Eagle Scout and a rescue diver as well.
Yes.
Wow, that is crazy. All right, Carson, so what I'm going to do now is hit you with all the hard questions and we'll get all the tough ones out of the way.
Sounds great.
All right. All right. Question number one, favorite movie?
Hands down, Top Gun. I'm sure you probably could have guessed that one, but I started watching Top Gun when I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and I've seen it probably over 800 times, and still to this day, I can quote the movie from front to end.
800 times.
Legitimately, I used to watch it about 2-3 times a week when I was little, and then on every flight, whether I'm going to a match or traveling, I watch it on each airplane leg.
Wow. Okay, so give me your thoughts on Top Gun 2. Maverick.
So for Top Gun 2, I liked it, but the original one is still my personal favorite just because of how iconic it is. But they did a really good job of capturing different things that you normally don't see when it comes to an aviation movie and using not necessarily CGI, but actual footage of aircraft. And that was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, Tom Cruise even talked about how many cameras they had in the cockpits and everything they did. And it was so difficult to film that they said you'll probably never see another movie filmed like this ever again.
Yeah, I believe that. I think they had like 8 or 9 different cameras in the cockpit, which takes up a lot of space, especially to get that high quality footage. And I really don't think with how all the aircraft are made nowadays that that's going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, pretty impressive. Well, now I guess I know what the driving force is behind you having your license, your pilot's license.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right. I have found that a lot of people don't read books anymore. With YouTube and audio books and podcasts and everything going on, most people don't read. If you read, what's your favorite book?
So the book that is my favorite at the moment is, it's called The Art of Clear Thinking, and it's written by Hazard Lee, who is an F-35 pilot. And so this book really goes into a lot of decision making and kind of breaking down certain things. And being an aviation related book, it was a lot easier for me to read than something that other people may like better. But I think it really tailors into shooting and time management and just kind of everyday life and how to weigh what you're doing at the time.
It's almost like a mental management book of sorts.
Yes.
F-35, you said?
Yeah. So he started flying F-16s and then basically helped develop the F-35 training program. And so that's where a lot of his knowledge comes from. And so the book kind of goes into his backstory, plus some of like the missions that he's flown and how different skills he used helped him, as well as talking about other companies such as Google and Microsoft and other big companies.
Now, I'm not sure if you're into superheroes or not, but if you are, who's your favorite superhero? If not, who's your favorite historical figure or both?
So I'm not really big into superheroes, but if I had to choose, I would say Iron Man, just because he can fly. And then for a historical figure, I said Doolittle from the Doolittle Raid back in World War II. And that's just because flying a B-25 off of an aircraft carrier was never done before. And kind of figuring that out, kind of trial and error, is something that takes a lot of guts to do. And it's a very interesting thing to look into.
Wow. So have you studied the Doolittle Raid at all?
A little bit. So growing up, probably from when I was five, all I watched was the History Channel, or back in the day, it was called the Military Channel. And it was all just World War II history. And so instead of watching cartoons, I pretty much just watched World War II history growing up. And so that was kind of my driving factor for, one, liking World War II history, and two, wanting to fly.
Yeah, that was their way of trying to intimidate the Japanese by hitting the mainland and saying, you're not out of reach, we're coming.
Yep.
Favorite gun and favorite caliber. It could be something you own, something you've shot, or something you want to shoot.
Okay. I would say favorite caliber is going to be 9mm, just because that's what I have the most experience loading, and I find it's the most fun and kind of easiest way to get into shooting, minus the 22. And then my favorite gun is going to be a Colt Python. And so I have one right here that Justine got me. But they just came out with a blued version, which is my personal favorite, but the silver looks just as good. And so the reason why the Colt Python is my favorite is actually Black Ops 2 Zombies, back from when I was little and played video games. This is kind of like the iconic gun along with like the Galil. And so actually owning a Python is really cool in my opinion.
When are you going to put a dot on that thing?
Honestly, never, just because I just love the look of it right now. Justine has an Anaconda with a RMR on top, but I like the look of the iron sights a little bit better on revolvers.
You could mount a scope on that thing and go hog hunting.
I know, that would be fun. I've never done it. We took it deer hunting, but I messed up and did not get the shot off in time, so we did not end up getting a deer.
Oh, how far would the shot have been?
It was probably 60 yards. So
wow.
very doable, but I was facing the wrong direction and I couldn't turn my body, and they're kind of just trotting along too quickly. So it happens though. Well, hopefully we'll get one next year.
There you go. The fifth question, I try to make it unique to the guest. Now, even though you're 19, you have visited a bunch of places, whether it be shooting or vacation, flying. What has been your favorite place that you've been to so far?
That's a tough one. So I've been very fortunate growing up. Both my parents really love to travel. And so I've actually been to 42 countries in all 50 states. And so having the opportunity to travel to all the different countries has really been eye-opening in ways that other people live versus how we live here in the United States, and just even between state to state. And I would say my favorite country is going to have to be Vietnam. And that's because I've never seen such, one, a beautiful place, depending on where you go, between like the forest there, the city, and everyone was super nice. And I believe I was 13 or 14 at the time, they let me rent a scooter and just drive around the city. And there's no cars pretty much, it's only scooters. So if you like stick your arm out, you'll take out two different scooters with like four people on each. And so it was just kind of a wild place to experience. And I also got to shoot an M60 there when we went to the tunnels. And so they had an M60 Browning 1919, and you could shoot different machine guns there. So that was kind of a neat experience.
Yeah, I mean, riding a scooter there, like you said, putting your arm out, that's kind of like going roller skating when it's crowded. You put your arms out, you're taking out multiple people.
Pretty much. And the neat thing about there is crosswalks. Like, there's no traffic lights or crossing signs. And so what you learn is you just have to walk and you don't change your pace, and the scooters will just go around you. And it's crazy to see different people and like what they have on their scooters. So I remember seeing a family of three on a scooter holding a pig that was tied and blindfolded. And then another guy had, it was just him, but he had 8 kegs of beer on the sides. So he had like 2 on the sides, 2 on the back, and like 2 stacked up top, and just kind of kept going. And just seeing like what all they can fit on these scooters driving around is kind of insane.
Now, would you trust U.S. drivers if you were to just walk across?
Not at all, no.
No, it'd be like, why is this idiot in the road? I'm going to hit him.
Exactly, yeah. Our drivers here are not that great.
And they don't care. They're like, I'm bigger than you. I'm going to take
exactly.
you out.
Exactly, yeah.
That's why I call motorcycles here in the States speed bumps.
Yeah, I know, no kidding. Especially yeah. in Arizona, you really got to be careful riding motorcycles.
All right. So Carson, I mean, most of the people I talk to are older in life, you know, whether it be in their 20s or 50s, you're younger, yes. but so, and as you said, you're a masterclass Karioptic shooter. So you've been in it for a little bit. How did you get introduced? Have you grown up with guns your whole life?
Yeah, so I have grown up with guns my whole entire life. Both my parents are from the Midwest and grew up on farms. So my first introduction to shooting was in Arizona, just going out into the desert and shooting 22s with my dad. I was probably 5 or 6 years old. You know, just we had a single action revolver 22 and a semi-auto like Ruger that we would just kind of shoot cans with. And then once I got kind of comfortable there, going back to my mom's farm in Missouri with my grandpa, as I grew up hunting there with him. And so deer hunting, I remember I was probably 9 or 10 at the time, and using a 243, I got my first 9-point buck, and just shooting there. And I would remember just going there and shooting probably about 1,000 rounds of 22 every like 3 or 4 days through his lever action at things, and just kind of having fun that way shooting rifles.
So at what point did you get introduced then to practical shooting?
Practical shooting has been pretty recent. So this is my 4th year doing it. I started in 2020 right before COVID, and I was just kind of like looking it up. I kind of saw multi-gun first. And so, you know, in class, I'd be like, I want a DVC-3 open gun, like kind of just kind of like looking at random guns that are right. So you always go from zero to whatever and look at the right. most expensive thing. But I was just kind of looking around, and I found a local Thursday match at C2 Tactical, which is a local indoor range here. And so I went there one night, and I started with an FNX 45 Tactical and Limited, shooting 45.
Whoa.
And goodness. Yeah, because that's what we had at the time. And so that's kind of what I had. I had an LAG holster and like a duty belt. Since I played airsoft, it was a little more tactical. And so that's what I started with. And just kind of getting into it there, we'd go once a week, and then COVID happened, but the range still stayed open. So we were able to still shoot every once in a while and still manage to practice there a little bit. And then after that, I did PCC for a little bit with a Scorpion Evo. So not an actual PCC, but it was still fun. And that was kind of what dabbled me into 9mm. And so after, I would say, maybe 6 months of shooting Limited and PCC, I got a SIG P320 X5 Legion with an RMR. And so that was my first carry optics gun, which I actually have it right here. So this is my original gun. Right now, it's just a Romeo 1 Pro okay. on it. But this was the original gun that got me into carry optics.
Okay. And is that silicone carbide?
It is, yes. So the one thing that I've found over the years in the shooting community is that everyone is super helpful and friendly. Like, I have not met one bad person pretty much in this community that doesn't want to help anyone. And so at that match, there are probably 30 or 40 of us, and I'm still pretty close with all of those people. And one of them helped me put in the gray gun's trigger, put in the carbide, and just kind of make it into a more shootable gun for carry optics.
Now, what are you shooting now if you're not using that one?
So right now I'm using the CZ Custom AO1LD. And so this is pretty much a little bit different than a Shadow 2. So instead of being a cast frame, it's actually milled and then hand fit together. So the tolerances are a lot better than a stock Shadow 2. And it also has a bull barrel. So instead of the normal barrel that you get a lot more accuracy out of this gun. And it's a CZ Custom gun, so you have a lot better of a trigger that's hand fit in there and really reliable. And then on top, I'm running a Holosun 507 comp as the red dot. So that's my main carry optics gun right now.
So it's a cheater gun.
It is.
It's an open gun in carry optics.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I love it. It's a lot similar. Like, if you think about it compared to a Shadow 2, that's more closer to a 2011, in my opinion, just because of the tolerances and accuracy that you get out of it. And it's being a little bit heavier, you get a lot more recoil control, which I find very beneficial for me because for some reason I cannot grip a gun to save my life. And so having that extra weight up front really helps keep that muzzle down for me. And then the benefit that I like the most is it takes P10 mags instead of a Shadow 2 mag. So you get more reliability, in my opinion, and more durability with the P10 mag over a standard Shadow 2 mag.
Do you get 23 rounds in your mag?
Yes.
Boom.
Yep. Okay. So you still get the same amount of rounds too.
Now, the 507 comp, how are you liking that?
I love it. I know it's a newer dot. And I find that just running it with a 2 MOA, just circle like a normal red dot is the way I like it to do it. I know some people who run the 32 MOA ring, but I found that just having that fine point is a lot better for me. And so far I have about 4,000 rounds through this dot specifically, and I love it. I was using a SRO before that, and the SRO is a very durable dot, but for some reason my eyes just did not like it. And I would struggle with adjusting the brightness to where I found it would be good for a target. So it would either be too dim or too bright. And that 507 comp just has a lot more adjustability in the dot brightness. So really fine tune what you want when you're at a match.
Hmm. Okay. I hadn't heard about that before. So that's a new one, especially, you know, having the experience of the SRO and the comp and then that difference there. I've not heard of that. That's new. That's good though. Okay.
Yeah, I found my eyes are really sensitive to how bright or dim a dot is, and it was just something that I could not get used to on the SRO, and so I just switched to the 507. And that's actually a new announcement that I have coming out soon, is I recently got sponsored by Holosun as well, so you'll be seeing a lot more 507s on all my guns.
Nice. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I really love their product, and at the price point compared to an SRO as well, for the same reliability, it's awesome.
You heard it here first, folks. Blah, 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 blah. You heard it here first. So we know that Top Gun was the whole reason you wanted to become a pilot. While you are a licensed pilot, you're not just stopping to get your pilot's license. You're also working on getting your instrument rating.
Yes. So growing up with that World War II history, is really Pearl Harbor is kind of what got me into flying and watching a lot of those aviation movies. And then Top Gun just happened to be the one that I got stuck on and watched. So I got my instrument rate or my private pilot certificate back in 2022 in October. I was still in high school at the time, senior year, and just kind of been flying since freshman year. After I finished my Eagle Scout project, I started flying and just been sticking with it ever since. And right now I'm at 180 hours, right around there. And just kind of finishing up my instrument rating. So I've been just studying for the practical test, and I'm going to do hopefully the practical test before the end of April. And so that'll get me my instrument rating. And then after that, I want to move on to my commercial and CFI and become a flight instructor, and then hopefully go to an airline by the age of 21.
Okay. You knew exactly where I was going because you just answered all of my questions, but let's get back there. So you're at 180 hours now. How many hours do you need to take the test?
So I have all the requirements to do the instrument rating. It's just been tough because I have midterms right now with college. So studying for both is kind of tough. So I'd say in the next 3 weeks or so, I'll have all the knowledge in my head and ready to go to take that test.
Now, what classes are you currently taking in college? What are your midterm tests?
So right now it's just kind of the basic intro classes for college. So I have calculus, psychology, econ, English, and then some major specific classes, which is called WP Carey. It's the name of the business school at ASU.
Okay. Arizona State.
Yep.
I was going to ask, because of the instrument rating, I was just trying to figure out where you were going to go with that, because most people don't necessarily need that, but you want to be a commercial airline pilot.
Yes. So the instrument rating allows for a lot more privileges that you don't get with just a normal private pilot's license. And so some of those privileges is flying class alpha airspace, which is above 18,000 feet, being able to file an IFR flight plan, which allows you to fly in clouds or in special VFR at night. So that's just kind of lower visibility areas. So it allows you to, if you're stuck at a place, kind of come home safely and know how to in reduced visibility. That's kind of the main reason for an instrument rating. But in order to go ahead and get your commercial and become a flight instructor, you got to have all of those ratings. And especially to go to an airline, you have to kind of get that step in order to progress in what you want to do.
So let's say you get all of these ratings, you become a flight instructor.
Yep.
At 21, what happens then? Are you going to flight school to be a commercial pilot then?
Yeah, so at 21, that's the age that you can actually get hired by an airline. So 18, you can become a flight instructor and build those hours, but 21 is when you can actually get hired by, let's say, Southwest or American or one of those companies. But you have to have experience first. So at 21, you go to a regional airline like SkyWest, which basically is like a service that rents out their pilots to American Eagle or Frontier or those smaller kind of airlines that do the smaller flights. So you'd fly for them for a minimum of 2 years to build your time and get that actual work experience and then apply for a job at Southwest or on any other airline.
Okay, I gotcha. That makes sense.
So in order to get hired by SkyWest first, which is kind of the interim goal at the moment, I have to become a flight instructor to build those hours so I can also make money at the same time. And so I need 1500 hours in order to apply for that job.
Ooh,
Yeah,
that's
so
a
it's a
few
steep.
hours.
Yeah, so it'll take a little bit, but we have time. So we'll get it done.
Now, how does that work? You're studying business financial planning, right?
Yes.
So similar to what your dad does?
Yeah, so my dad's a financial planner based out of Arizona, but he's licensed in pretty much every state. There's a few that he's not. But my brother recently just came on board with him as well as a paraplanner and is working with my dad. And so it's kind of the family business. And so eventually, possibly one day, if flying doesn't work out or if I ever retire from that, I can always hop into financial planning and help out here. Yeah, so it's really just a backup too. If flying doesn't work out, I have another job that I can do as well.
Now, I want to go back for a second because talking about you'd mentioned military history, and I don't know if you mentioned Pearl Harbor at all, but you were at Pearl Harbor for a December 7 ceremony, were you not?
Yes. So part of the traveling that we have done is, I believe I was in kindergarten or first grade at the time. My parents took me to Pearl Harbor for the 70th anniversary of the attack. And so that was, even being that young, it was still a very powerful experience to be there and to see at the time the survivors that were still alive and at the ceremony. And so I, in my house, I have a poster of just a picture of Pearl Harbor and some of the ships, and it has some of the zeros that were coming down. And I had all of the survivors sign the poster. And one story I remember distinctly, and I don't remember what ship it was that he was on, but he remembers being in one of the towers on the ship and seeing that plane on my poster and remembering seeing the pilot had a gold tooth because of how close the plane was when it flew over the ship. And so
Ooh.
being able to talk to these survivors and kind of let them tell me their story to be able to pass it on to other people is kind of a very powerful experience. And then a couple of years after that, I was able to go to Normandy for the 70th anniversary of D-Day. And so I have another poster from Pointe du Hoc and where I got to meet survivors from D-Day and have them sign that as well.
Holy cow. Probably the two most remembered events of World War II.
Yeah, definitely. And back to Pearl Harbor is, I think I've been to Pearl Harbor about 8 times now on separate trips. It's just something that I really love going there. And a few years ago, I found out that my nanny, who's I believe 86 at the right now, her cousin, Father Al Schmidt, was the first chaplain to die in World War II, and he was on the USS Oklahoma at Pearl Harbor. And so I kind of did a little bit of research about him because it's a small world. And so last time we were able to go to Pearl Harbor, I found his memorial stick off of the USS Missouri Memorial. And so I got to take a picture with it and I did some research. And a couple of years ago, they actually found his body on the ship and was able to send it back to Iowa so he could be buried properly.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, there's all kinds of, you're learning all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it's a, as you find out more and more with everything, it's a small world and there's a lot of connections between everything.
Now, did she find out about that through you?
Yeah, so she knew that he passed away there, but she was young at the time, so she didn't really know a lot about him. So I was able to kind of find out a lot of information about him and kind of keep that memory alive because it was on her other side of the family that they were close with. But she was, I believe, 6 or 7 at the time, so pretty young.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I want to talk about this rescue diver.
Okay.
So, how long have you been a rescue diver?
So Rescue Diver has been fairly recent. I believe 2021 is when I got that. And so that is a PADI certification that I have. I got scuba certified a couple years ago when I was at Boy Scout camp on Catalina Island. And so I did all of my certifications on Catalina Island, which is a really cool place to learn how to dive because of the marine life that they have there. And so I remember spending a week there and doing all sorts of diving, all sorts of different activities, and being able to see sharks diving in the kelp forest. We got stuck in a bait ball on a night dive, so it was pitch black and we had flashlights, and thousands and thousands of those little fish that are like 3 or 4 inches long were literally pelting you, and you could feel them like hitting your mask. Like, it was kind of scary. Like, and so they're kind of just pelting us. And then we surfaced on that dive, and it happened to be the 4th of July. So when we floated to the surface, you can't see the coast of California, but kind of vaguely. But all the fireworks were going off on the coast, and it was kind of illuminating the water. And so it was a really cool thing to see, just floating in the ocean, pitch black, and just seeing fireworks going off miles and miles away on the coast. And then when we got out of the water and took our gear off, all those little fish that pelted us were in our gear. So we had to clean that out. And that was kind of gross, but I'll
Fish
always
fry.
remember that. I know. I'll always remember that. I think I had
Oh, wow.
20 or 30 fish pulled out of my gear alone, let
Good
alone the four
Lord.
people. Yeah, it was quite a bit.
At any moment or at any time, did you go, I hope there's no shark around here?
I know. At the moment, I was like, oh, wow, this is neat. And then after I got out of the water, I was like, usually they only do that if they're getting attacked, and that's kind of their defense mechanism. So I'm sure other animals were eating those fish that we were inside of swimming in. So try not to think of that ever again.
Right. Yeah, you know. Years later it's okay, but not at that time.
Exactly, yeah.
Holy cow. Now we'll get back to the shooting part of this stuff.
Sounds great, yeah.
That's a diverse background though, I gotta say. Now you got into practical shooting, you said about 2020.
Yes.
So in 2021, I guess you started getting a little bit more serious about it, or at what point did you go, you know what, I want to do more than just go and shoot and have fun.
Yeah, so it was probably around 2021, maybe 2022 Nationals was my first bigger match that I remember. And just starting off at the Thursday local matches, it was just kind of a thing. You got better, people helped you out. It was just a fun thing to do at once a week. And then after about 6 to 8 months, I started kind of wanting to do it more and more. And that's when one of my friends took me out to Rio Salado. And so I shot my first Rio match there. And that was a whole nother world. Like, even though it's still Arizona, like going from an indoor range to an outdoor range that on a weekend had 200 plus shooters was just kind of insane to think about. Like, you wouldn't think, oh, I'm gonna go do this, and that's a lot of people there, you know? And so at that time, I was shooting a Shadow 2. And so did my first Rio match. And then being in Phoenix, we're fortunate to be able to shoot pretty much every day of the week except Friday. And so I got really into it, and I was shooting about 3 to 4 times a week at a match, not practice, just a match. And that's kind of when my skills took off, is because I didn't have a place to practice yet, but I was using matches as my practice, which can progress you until a certain point. And so I was shooting 4 times a week, different matches, different types of guns, and just having a blast at it. And then finally, I went to Area 4, which was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and that was my first big match that I remember. And I believe I placed 10th in carry optics at that one. And it was just kind of cool to see a whole nother side of the shooting sport traveling across the country to shoot a match.
So that was your first major?
That was my first major, yes.
Okay. Now, how far is it from where you are to Tulsa?
It's about a 3 hour flight, give or take, I believe.
Oh, hop, skip, and a jump. Not bad at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So that was the first major, and I remember, I believe Jacob Hetherington won carry optics at the time, and he was unclassified. And I was still so confused with that because I was so new to the sport and learning the classifications. I was like, how can someone not be classified and win overall in carry optics? And so I just remember, like, that stumped me for a while. And then I'm like, oh, he shoots for the AMU, and just kind of connected the dots a little bit.
Kind of like when JJ won Carry Optics Nationals as an unclassified shooter.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
Yeah,
not
these
knowing a
guys are
lot.
cheating.
Exactly. Not knowing a lot about the sport and who everyone is, it was kind of funny because when I started dating Justine, she'd be like, oh, yeah, like JJ. And I'm like, who? Like, I don't know anyone. So she's like, oh, yeah, that person, that person. And then finally, I started recognizing everyone. And we were at a match. I don't remember where, but my dad was sitting on a table wearing a Bass Pro hat. And Max Michelle comes up to my dad and he's like, oh, nice hat. And my dad's like, oh, thanks. I shop at Bass Pro. And then like went back to like texting on his phone because he has no clue who anyone is either. And we're just like staring at my dad like, oh, my God, like, why is Max talking to you? Like, it was just kind of funny. And he's like, oh, I have no clue who he is, and just went back down to texting.
That's funny. Did you meet Justine at a match?
Yeah. So the first match that we met was in St. George, Utah, at her home, not her home range, but at the PCSL range for a PCSL match. And she was an RO along with Glenn. And it was a lot of us from Phoenix that went up there to shoot the match. And we're kind of a cluster when it comes to all of us in a group. And so there's a part where the stage is like at the very bottom of a hill, and one of our friends was being slow. So we just left them there and drove up. So we had to walk up, and Glenn and Justine were not happy that we left one of our squad people at the bottom, because that delayed the stage from being shot by us. And when it came up to my turn, she thought I had a foot fault and was trying to give me a foot fault, but Glenn was saying that I didn't. And so it was kind of like a little bit of an argument there on if I actually got a foot fault or not. And then after the match, we just started talking, and then the rest has been history. Now we pretty much shoot all over the country together, and it's great.
So you guys, it all started over a disagreement.
It did all start over a disagreement. Yeah.
It's like an episode of Friends.
Yeah.
That's funny. Oh, Lord. You also shoot rifle because you were just at the IWI carbine shootout. Before we get into the carbine stuff, though, do you shoot anything? So I assume multi-gun, USPSA, and carbine, anything else?
No, that's pretty much it. Just those three and then hunting. I haven't done any PRS stuff or any of that kind of things. I've done a couple IDPA matches just for fun. Found out that that wasn't really my jam, so went back to USPSA.
It's shooting, so it's fun, but I get it.
Exactly, yeah.
So getting back to the carbine thing for a minute, as I said, you were just on the East Coast shooting the carbine shootout.
Yeah.
I know Justine is getting ready for Rifle World shoot. Mm-hmm. Do you plan also on making a trip over there?
I do, yes. So I recently was awarded a slot from USPSA to go to Finland for a Rifle World shoot. So later this year, probably in the next couple of months, I'll be practicing a lot more with carbine to prepare for that as well.
Okay. So tell me about the IWI carbine shootout. Like, in comparison to a USPSA match, give me the differences.
Yeah. So the IWI was a really interesting match, being that it was a hit factor scoring. And that's not something you see a lot in multi-gun, two-gun, but minus PCSL, and that's kind of a new thing, right? And so it was very neat to see rifle targets that weren't right in your face or out at 400 yards. You had a really good mix of everything at that match. And they tried to follow an IPSC format. So you had a couple long courses, you had a couple short courses, you had some long range. But the neat thing that I saw that I've never seen before is they had mini targets. So they had, I believe, half size to third size IPSC targets out to like 50, 60 yards, 30 yards. And trying to shoot alphas on things like that is really hard because the A zone is literally like 2 inches by an inch and a half. And so realizing how important points are in that kind of match was really eye-opening, not for me, but for also all the three gunners, because it's not just two on paper. And so having to take that time to aim, it was interesting to see how some really good three gunners didn't do as well, and some people who weren't good at rifle did better, and it kind of evened out the playing field.
Yeah, it's normally what, time plus?
Yeah, it's normally time plus, so one alpha or two hits anywhere.
Right. Now, what was the farthest target you did have to engage?
I believe it was 560 yards at that match, and that was a struggle for me. So Straylock, which had all my data at the time, got deleted because it was banned after the war in Ukraine.
Oh, yes.
I lost all of my rifle data. So going into this match, I had absolutely nothing. But I'm like, oh, like before we left, we shot out around 500 yards in 30 mile an hour crosswind during a thunderstorm, just for fun. And I was like, second shot impact on a C-zone steel. And I was like, oh, I got this. Like, I'm ready to go, right? But I didn't take into the fact that in Arizona, everything's dirt. So when you shoot at a target, you'll always see where that round impacts if it doesn't hit the target. But that is not like South Carolina. It's all trees and wet grass. And so I did a sitting reload on the, I went one for one all the way out to 350 yards, missed like one or two shots on the 430, and then spent probably 15 rounds on the 560 yard target just trying to hit that thing because it was worth like 50 or 60 points, I believe.
And oh, so, wow. So it was worth spending the time.
It was worth spending the time because after the fact we equated it, I think it was worth 8 or 9 mics if I didn't hit it. And so
now
I realize that I really have to go back and get my data for my rifle so I know what I'm doing. But it's still a fun long range is just something that is always a blast, no matter wherever you do it. It's always fun to do.
So did you engage that in a prone position?
It was on a rooftop, so kind of a 45-degree angle out of a window. So we had a bag on the front and then just rested the gun and kind of squatted a little bit. So it was the stage itself was 2 IPSC paper, one at 160 yards and one at 230. And then it was 5 steel from 100 yards out to 600. And so just kind of engaging all of that. And luckily, we didn't have too much wind, but enough to hold off target a little bit.
So what were you running for an optic?
So I'll grab my rifle right here. So on this, I have the Vortex Razor 1 to 10. So this is the Gen 3, I believe. And so this is also the mil reticle in this one. So instead of running a BDC like a lot of people do, I prefer the mil reticle. And then on my offset at the moment, I have an SRO, but that's going to be a 507 comp probably later this afternoon. I'll be switching that out. And so this will be my rifle. I'm taking the world shoot. So cool thing about this is it's an 18-inch barrel plus the comp, but the upper handguard is made out of magnesium. So it's super light. And then the upper receiver is made out of lithium aluminum. So even though it's an 18-inch gun with a really heavy scope, it only weighs about 7 pounds, 8 ounces.
With the scope?
With the scope, yeah.
Wow, that's impressive.
So I've weighed some 16-inch carbon fiber guns by like Smoke Composites, and they're right around 9 pounds, depending on what optic you run. And so having that extra barrel length and still being lighter is kind of a neat thing. And I built this with one of my friends here, Kevin. And I love this gun so much. It's just such a pleasure to shoot, especially with the unrivaled break and buffer. This thing has like no recoil whatsoever.
Well, and let's talk about that real quick. Cause, I was looking on your Instagram page. I don't see it, but was it Unrivaled Technologies?
Yes. Unrivaled Technologies. So
they make
a hydraulic buffer system, which is in this rifle. And it's made, they have one for a duty gun, so a full mass bolt carrier group, as well as a lightened one. So I'm running the lightened one. And then their comp is the newest feature on this gun. So I was running the Titan SJC Extreme beforehand, and I had all of the screws taken out on the top to help reduce recoil with that gun. And it was still climbing and climbing and climbing. And the cool thing about the Unrivaled one is, one, I only have 3 out of the 4 screws taken out, and it's pushing my gun down. And so I actually need to put a screw back in to kind of undo that because of how powerful this comp is. But it also has adjustable screws all the way around. So you can actually adjust for left and right movement with the rifle. So I found that my gun was climbing up and going to the right. So I can actually take out a screw to adjust that to make it come back to center. But a cool thing that they did that I did not know was possible is they actually have Allen keys that have a hole in the center of them. So you could either have a screw, a no screw, or if that's too much adjustment, you can put an Allen key that has a hole in it. So then you have a smaller hole to kind of do a finer adjustment.
Like a narrower diameter and not fully open.
Yep. So it's just, instead of a fully open one, that's just partially open.
Cool. Wow. Yeah.
It's a really neat break, and I recommend it for anyone who's using an AR. I mean, compared to the SJC, like, this is so much better, in my opinion.
All right, we're going to nerd out for a minute. What caliber, I mean, not caliber, duh, what bullet weight are you using in that thing?
So I listened to your podcast with AJ, and he said the three types of people. I am 55 grain all the way.
Oh, no.
I know. It's terrible, but I do it, and it's kind of fun because you can always, people make fun of you for it, but I find it funny. And okay. So I run Barry's 55 grain with some Shooter's World tack powder, and it's just a great load. I'm still developing a load for this rifle, and so still kind of testing certain things with that. But when I was using factory ammo a year ago or so, I had a hit at 790 yards with this gun.
Okay. On purpose or accident?
No, on purpose. I was taking a class with Rob Latham and Travis McCamish, and we were getting our data for long range, and we were truing it. So I was shooting it like 600 yards, or give or take, and just testing data. And once we got that data correct, I swung over to a 800-yard target pretty much and shot that, and it was first-round impact on that target.
Good job.
Thank you. Yeah, so it's a really fun... And that was with 55s too, so people can say what they want about having
right
55s, but it works.
Right. It does. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
Is the barrel twist set up then for the 55?
Yes, so it's a 1-8 twist. And so I haven't tested anything heavier yet. I'm planning on possibly getting some Barry 62 grain, but just being still so new to rifle and loading, I just want to kind of stick with 55s for now until I figure out everything that I need to do. Because I know if I get 62s for long range, which aren't that heavy, but Barry's makes them, and I've found that they're very accurate, I just want to zero it for that and try and only use one round if it's out past, especially having to shoot for accuracy. I don't want to try and mix up my ammo.
I agree with you there. Yeah, you want to stick, even if it's 55, if that's what you find that you like, you know, figure it out, stick with it, and go with it. I'm 100% in agreement there. So, okay. So how deep into ballistics have you gotten with this stuff, shooting rifle?
Not terribly deep. I'm still learning quite a bit about it. And after Strelak got deleted, it was kind of a struggle getting that data back. But I finally found another app that I can use. I believe it's called GeoBallistics. And so I just found that in South Carolina. So I'm putting all my data in there. And so then in the next couple months, I'll be testing that and truing it and kind of figuring out all sorts of different stuff. But I would say because of flying and weather, knowing how to do the weather calculations and wind and all of that stuff is actually pretty easy for me. It's just figuring out and testing it, really.
I mean, it's all offset navigation.
Yeah. So it's just,
it really is. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just kind of figuring it out and testing.
When I was in the military, we did over the horizon insertion in boats. Mm-hmm. And you had to do offset navigation. It's no different than offsetting the navigation of a plane to adjust for wind and other stuff. So it's all the same. That's what a bullet is. You're offsetting the navigation of the bullet to adjust for the wind.
Exactly, right?
It's so, all freaking related.
So, it is all related.
And so, I feel your pain with Strelak, because I had it too and it got deleted. Yeah. I lost all of my stuff too.
Luckily, I wasn't too big into long range, so I really only had this rifle in there and that was it. I'm sure people who do PRS had all sorts of data in there that's all gone. But I know it's unfortunate.
I had my Remington 700 with a 175 and 168 grain projectiles in there, and I had my 6.5 with 140 grain in there.
So yeah, that's a lot of data.
It is a lot of data.
It takes time too. It's not like just zeroing a pistol and, you know, testing some groups. It takes a lot of time to set up targets, get actual groupings, get all that data in your phone or into whatever you have.
Yeah. Have you tried the Hornady Fordoff?
I have not. I looked into it a little bit when I was looking at Kestrels, just because it's it takes the angle of attack of the bullet rather than the ballistic coefficient, I believe.
Yeah.
And I've heard different reviews on it, but I might look into it a little bit more. Do you know anything about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very good because I started using it because my 6.5, I used the 140 ELDM.
Okay.
So a Hornady bullet. So it's in there, but they've tested, so they got a ballistic radar and they've been able to test the, I forget how many thousands of points of reference they get on every projectile out to like 1,000 yards.
Wow.
Yeah. And then they program all that into their FORDOF program. So there's no guesstimation. And they add bullets that they test all the time from other manufacturers. They're in there. I'm not sure if Barry's is in there or not, but it might be. But if you know the data, the information, you can still plug it in and it'll get you closer than a normal ballistic program. So,
oh, that's cool. So does it just take like the length of the projectile, the drag model, and then like the ballistic coefficient? Or
yeah, it takes a combination of, they call it 4 degrees of freedom.
Freedom. Yeah.
Yeah. So it adds a fourth axis and mm-hmm. they calculate all of that stuff together. It'd be something to worth looking into. It might, and yeah. it's free. So
is
no,
it?
Yep.
Oh, okay. So is it
no,
just an
no
app
charge
on the
there?
Phone?
Yep.
Oh, wow. Okay. Cause I know they had it with a Kestrel. So that's what I was looking into, but I think that's like $600 or $700. But if it's
yeah,
free,
Kestrel,
I'll definitely
yeah.
have to look into it because that's definitely worth it playing with just to see.
Yeah, I mean, you might as well. And once you get the data, you can compare and see how it comes out and how accurate
yeah.
it is. So,
because I've found that a lot of different products have different formulas. So, for example, my Stralock would give me a different number than my Vortex binoculars that had their applied ballistics in it.
Hmm. Okay. Did you make a correlation as to which one was closer?
Yeah, so Stralock was accurate out to that 790 yards and giving me exact data and holds. And the Vortex binoculars were always about an MOA to 2 MOA off. And I don't know if that was just, I know, I couldn't figure it out. So maybe this summer I'll kind of go back and play with it because I was just thinking maybe I didn't put in a piece of data correctly or what, but we'll compare it with FORDOF and I'll let you know.
Okay. Yeah. I would be curious.
Yeah.
So how are you liking the 1-10 Vortex for shots out to 600 yards?
I love it. So I started shooting multi-gun / two gun with a Daniel Defense DDM4 V7 and a Razor 1-6 with a BDC reticle. So that was my original two gun rifle. And then a Dissident as a shotgun, and then my Shadow 2 is my handgun. And I love the Gen 3, I believe, so much more. Just having the 1-10 and the different reticle, I find that being able to look at targets and see them a little bit closer, the glass is still so clear that you can still see your impacts here in Arizona and find the targets relatively easy.
Are you changing the magnification between targets?
I run an offset red dot, so if it's within 30 yards, no. And if it's past that, I usually set like 3 power. I found myself to be right around 3 power from like 100 yards and in for this last match in South Carolina because I had to aim for points. And that was with the mini targets, full-size targets, etc. And that was good. And then once I hit that 200 to that 500-600 yard, I found myself going anywhere from 8 to 10 power. And once I set it for long range, I kind of just left it there and ran with it. And just being able to have that 10X on those 500-600 yard targets makes it a lot easier when they're small. And I believe in Finland too, we'll have papers out to 200-300 yards. And so being able to kind of crank that magnification onto them might be beneficial compared to 1-4 or 1-6.
Is it a second focal plane?
I believe it's a first focal plane because it's the, you can't see the reticle when it's on 1 power. And then once you zoom all the way to 10, you can see it then.
Okay.
I always get those confused.
Okay. So yeah, it's our first focal plane.
Yeah.
All right. So you said there was a stage in South Carolina where the paper was what, 130 and 260.
Yeah.
And then,
I went to steel.
And then, so were you using the 8 to 10 power for that stage?
On that stage, I set it on 10 power. Actually, I just thought I'm going to maximize this magnification all the way out. And it was really good. And that's the thing with the vortex that I found is even in low light on 10 power, you can still see very well. So I believe we shot that stage late, like sunset was 6:30 and it was probably 5:45, 5:50. And so it was cloudy and foggy that day. The weather rained so much. I wore mud boots on out of 12 stages, 11 out of the 12, I had mud boots up to my knees on because of how gross it was. And being from Phoenix, it never rains. So I'm not used to this mud thing, you know? But
welcome to the swamp.
Exactly. Even in low light though, the 1 to 10 did really well on 10 power. Cause a lot of people, you might think like you're not going to be able to see that reticle being dark. And I didn't have it illuminated either. Like I had it black, so I could still see really well.
Okay. So you didn't turn on the illumination.
I did not, no.
Okay. I'm not a big fan of the illuminated reticle. So I think it tends to distract me from the target. So that's why I prefer not to.
Yeah. There are a couple stages where I wish I would have just for close targets, but I don't want to finick with it going from a close to long range, having to adjust brightness. So I just left it off.
Okay. Makes sense. Now that was a straight carbine, right? There was nothing else you guys were shooting.
Nothing else. It was carbine only.
Now, knowing that you got a slot to rifle world shoot and you shot the IWI carbine shootout, what was the takeaway Monday morning after that match?
So the takeaway for me was figuring out ammo because I'm new to loading 223. And so I was riding the line on cycling my rifle reliably. And so I think I had some that were slightly underpowered because my bolt would randomly short stroke. And so I'd have to just rack it. But it was one every like three rounds and one mag every stage pretty much. Like it wasn't often. It was just once a stage. And it was really weird. So I got to diagnose that. And so this weekend I'll be using, I'm bumping up my powder a little bit to see if that'll be the issue just to kind of self-diagnose. And so that was the biggest takeaway in terms of gear. In terms of the match, I would say practicing going from an offset to a scope and back and forth, because there are a lot of places where you would have a 20-yard open target and then a 10-yard mini, but you want to use your scope for the mini and your offset for the open target. And so being able to quickly go back between each was something that I have not practiced before. And so it's something I'll need to work on.
So transitions raise their ugly head once again, but not between targets, literally between sighting options. Okay.
And even being comfortable with using that throw lever on the scope between targets too, because talking to AJ, he shoots TAC Ops mainly. So he always, you know, switches between his magnification. And so figuring out what works better for me is if it's rolling the gun to use an offset or just throwing different magnifications between targets.
Did you find that you had to use the mil dot reticle at any time for hold off?
I found that for holds, it was very beneficial, but not knowing the data made it a little bit hard just because I had to kind of guess to where it would be and then kind of critique from there. And not being able to see those impacts or being able to see trace was kind of rough on some of those stages, but we still ended up hitting every target in it. So it worked out. I think that practicing without having those second shot corrections is going to be important for Finland because of the type of environment that's going to be there. I'm assuming it's going to be probably a little bit cloudy and grass and wet. And so not being able to see those impacts will make it tough on the farther shots.
Yeah. And it's not going to be nearly as hot as Phoenix at that time.
No, I am not looking forward to it because we'll be in like full swing 120 here and like shorts and a t-shirt. And then it'll probably be 50 or 60 there. And I'll be in winter clothes, like bundled up.
So. And I'm like 50 to 60. That's short weather. What are you talking about?
I know. It's
but
so
I'm with
funny.
You.
Like in Phoenix, we have two seasons. It's winter and summer, and there's no in between. So
I feel like it's summer, 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 fall, summer, 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 fall.
Yeah, okay, maybe like that. Maybe winter doesn't happen, but
it might even be summer, hell, summer, fall, summer, hell, summer. Anyway, it gets hot.
Yeah, you're right. At. It does get hot.
Whew, I don't know how you guys do it. That is, I am not a heat person like that.
I'm not a winter person. So I think it's just whatever you're used to the most and you just roll with it.
According to your Instagram, that's not true because I've seen plenty of snow pictures in your Instagram.
That is true. Where I practiced, it's about an hour drive from my house, and we have a cabin another 30 minutes past the range, and so it's at 6,300 feet, so we do get snow, and so having the cooler weather, it's always about 15 to 20 degrees cooler there, so practicing in the summer makes it a lot nicer because we're not at 120, we're only at 110, you know?
Yeah, that's all.
Yeah, all better.
Yeah. Good Lord, I'd still die of a heat stroke. All right,
just
so now let's
water.
And lots of it. Yeah. All right, so let's go back then to practical shooting.
Okay.
So shooting carry optics, how much of that are you going to be doing this year knowing that you're also prepping for World Shoot?
I will still be shooting carry optics a lot this year. And so I believe last year I shot about 33,000 rounds through my CO gun. And so this year it'll probably still be around 28 to 30, I would say, maybe a couple thousand short, because I still have IPSC Nationals coming up, which I'll be shooting production optics as well as carry optics nationals in June. So I still want to practice a lot with CO and get good and, you know, stay proficient with the carry optics gun. But also dabbling rifle in between is I think it's a lot easier to go from shooting carry optics to shooting rifle versus switching from carry optics to production or another handgun, just because they're two extreme ends. So you're not overlapping. You're not overlapping that kind of workload. You can kind of stick with one handgun, stick with one rifle and roll with it.
Yeah. You don't get those blurred lines, you know?
Yeah. Like, I'm not going to accidentally reload randomly or, like, do something like that, right?
Right. So. While we're talking about this, how has the ACE virtual reality helped your practical shooting skills?
I love the ACE. And so at first I was, like, not skeptical, but just, like, is it going to be, like, what it seems like it's going to be by watching all their Instagram videos. And then I went to SHOT Show and I tried it and I had so much fun doing that. And then I ended up getting it like 2 weeks later. And I believe in the first 2 weeks we had 30,000 rounds through it. And that is with Justine and I doing it. So if you see me on the leaderboard, it's probably her, not me, but and it's under my name, but we shot about 30. We have probably 35,000 through it right now. And I think there's no better way to practice swingers and like visual cues than ACE, just because like how often do you get to go to a range or practice and be able to set up a swinger and run that over and over and over again? Because it's so hard to, in some places in the winter or in the summer, like to get out to a match and you only get one of those or like a clam, you only have one chance to shoot a stage. You don't get to run it over and over again. And that's where ACE comes in, is I can practice different activation sequences and visual cues. I know I struggled a lot with moving the dot from point A to point B and transitioning and just finding that point on the target to aim. And I think ACE is really helpful with that. I think also as well as I have found that I like shoot a run like how I would practice and I'm like, that was good. And then I like look to the left at the leaderboard and I was like, what the hell? Like that's a 10 hit factor and the top is a 30. And I'm like, then you kind of start getting in that mindset of like trying to do it as fast as possible. But if you just take your time and it's almost like dry fire, like you want to see what you're doing so you can get better. So if you put the same effort of dry fire you do into the VR for visual learning, I think it pays dividends. I know I did a lot of single stack work before Western States, which I shot a couple weeks ago, and I haven't touched a single stack since the last time I shot Western States, and I didn't practice with it but once. And I had a lot more, I had like a lot less mics than I thought I was going to just by doing ACE and practicing where to aim on targets with iron sights.
Now, I know there has been chatter on people who don't have it about lack of recoil. I shot it. I played with it at Prairie Fire Nevada right before SHOT Show. Yeah. So I've got some experience with it, but you said you use a heavy gun because for whatever reason, you can't grip a gun to save your life.
Yep.
So what did you have to do with the ACE? Because if you don't hold that gun, that dot is all over the place.
It is all over the place. And that was part of the reason why, that was the first thing that I noticed when I picked it up at SHOT Show, is because I picked it up thinking it's, you know, like a fun thing to do. And I wasn't really holding the gun seriously. And I was missing I was missing everything. And so even though it doesn't have recoil, I still think that it's a good trainer because the dot still moves quite a bit if you don't hold it properly. And so for the people who shoot a 320, this thing's great for them because it's an identical platform. And I think it really transitions well to maintaining that grip pressure throughout a stage. Because I find that I spend 20 minutes on ACE and my hand starts to hurt because of how much I'm gripping it. And so I think it's almost conditioning myself to grip my gun better and more consistently over long periods of time by using it.
I actually think I gripped that ACE controller stronger than I do my gun in dry fire.
I would agree. I think it's because you want to do better and you want to push yourself in it. And dry fire, you're kind of only competing with yourself. Like you have the targets, you set up hard time possibly, and then you run it and you're like, oh, like that was good, right? But in ACE, because you have that leaderboard, you want to do as best as you can. And so it really pushes you to get focused into your dry fire.
And I think there's a second thing though here too, because I've done a lot of thinking about it. And when I'm in my garage dry firing and I've got my targets up and I'm shooting, I grip it as hard as I need to call my hits.
Yeah.
Well, in ACE, you can't just grip it tight enough to call your hits because you have instant feedback. When you're shooting that Texas Star and and the steel's not falling, you got to keep gripping it tighter until the steel starts falling.
Exactly. It's all about that dot placement and making sure it doesn't move. And I've taken ACE to a couple of my friends' houses and even my godfather. And these are people who haven't really shot guns before and are not often, and they love it. And I think my godfather is actually going to get one because he's like, this is so fun. And like, and just people love it. And I think it's a good trainer for those people who don't have a lot of time with handguns and don't have the means to get out to the range. Because I mean, you can shoot as much ammo as you want out of that thing for 300 or however much it is, $230 a year compared to shooting 9mm. Like a lot of people don't have the means to go out to the range every week, let alone like every month to practice. And so this is a very good alternative to that. It doesn't replace it, like not at all. Like you still have to go shoot and be proficient at that, but it's a very good supplement to it.
Well, and for, so I agree 100%. And then there are people like me, I am a member of an Isaac Walton out here, but they have so many range rules. I can't move and shoot. I'm not allowed to rapid fire. So that means if I do anything more than double tap, I have to transition to another target or yeah. Or they're going to say I'm just rapid firing, even though I could show them the target that I'm at, like a bill drill. That is rapid fire. Can't do that.
Wow.
So for people like me that would like to get out and do that stuff and can't, the ACE virtual reality now is my opportunity to do all of these things. I'm not allowed to shoot steel at the range. Well, now here's an opportunity to shoot steel. So for anybody who's limited in what they can do in live fire because of range rules, the ACE VR helps bring that into your living room or your garage or wherever and allow you to do those things you normally can't do.
Exactly. And back to the ACE with movement, I completely forgot. Like it's not all just stand and shoots. I can run a classifier course and actually run around my house as long as I don't run into a wall, but you can set the boundaries so you don't do that. Right. And so if you can't move on the range, like if you're at an indoor range or whatever, like it's still a big benefit. And even from me coming from Phoenix, where we're so fortunate to have a match pretty much every day of the week and be able to go to tons and tons of different ranges and practice, I still think that there's a benefit to ACE. Like, even though I can go to a range, shoot steel, do build drills, run around, set up whatever, like, I still think there's a benefit.
I agree. What are your thoughts on, I'll use Christian as an example. Like, when he went to college, mm-hmm. he was away from home on campus, so he couldn't dry fire or do anything because he couldn't have a weapon there.
Yeah.
I don't, that's not the situation with you. But what are your thoughts if you were to put yourself in his shoes today and have an ACE virtual shooting system with you?
I honestly wish we could watch him redo that with an ACE and see what would happen, because I think that'd be amazing. Just being able to have that in a dorm room or like wherever you are to practice would save so much of that learning process that you lose when you're not around them. Like, even if I haven't touched my carry optics gun since the match in Puerto Rico, and I'll be shooting 2-gun this weekend. And I think I still lose probably a lot of fundamentals when I don't pick up my gun weekly. Like, I see a deficit when I'm not dry firing, I'm not handling it or shooting. Like, handgun shooting is one of those things that your skills drop off significantly when you're not around it often. And so, if I were to have an ACE in the dorm room or wherever I would be practicing, if I wasn't fortunate enough to like live at home or be so close to school like I am right now, I think that it really would keep up with your manipulations, because you can still pretend to do a reload. You still have to grip it properly, like, and you still get the visual cues. So you're getting everything you would if you were just dry firing.
So I didn't know, or maybe I just forgot, that you went to the Caribbean Open.
Yes.
How was that?
That is probably my favorite match in this area, or like the US. I mean, one, the range is beautiful. Puerto Rico is just such an awesome place. The weather is always awesome. And it did not rain this year, which is a big plus for me.
Because
the last time it poured, and it was just, it's hard to shoot in the rain. Like, I feel like I melt in the rain just being from Arizona. Like, we don't get that a lot. So that was rough for me the first year, but this year was great. The stages are probably by far the best stages I've shot, hands down. That's not Barry Steel Open or Red Rock Rumble. Like, I love them more than Area 2, and it possibly could have been because of the scenery. Just not being at your own home range makes a difference, right? Because that's what you're used to all the time. And it was a good mix because of IPSC style, right? So you have that format of IPSC, but with some more USPSA rules. And so having that combo was great, because I feel like in Phoenix, we get a lot of technical stuff and a lot of hard things. So we're more accurate based here, versus Caribbean Open was a good mix of closer partial stuff that you could kind of rip on a little bit more. And I've never met more friendly people in my life than there. Like, it's always a blast. They always just want to have fun. They're always very nice. Like, there was no issues whatsoever. Like, I think we had to wait maybe once the whole match. Like, it was run very well.
Now, is that a staff reset?
It is not a staff reset.
Okay. And you're still just constantly moving, huh?
Yep. Still constantly moving. I mean, it was run so well. I mean, I think we waited, like 30 minutes maybe, but that was like on our last stage and they let us shoot a little bit.
Yep. So you said, before we were so rudely interrupted by the internet, you said you had like a 30-minute wait on the last stage, but they were going to let you shoot and you got cut off.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we had to wait maybe 20 minutes, 30 minutes, but they let us kind of go to the next stage. We had a little bit of a break, a little bit of a lunch, and then we got to shoot the last stage of the day. That match has just been run so well and everyone's been so kind there. And I think if you haven't been to the Caribbean Open yet, definitely make it on your list for 2025 because of how well that match is run. I think it's also a great match to start if you haven't traveled out of the country for a match or even like out of the state, just because it's in the US. So it's not too hard to get to, especially if you're in like Florida or on the East Coast. And like, it's still technically out of the country, so you have to fill out permits, but it kind of gives you that real world experience of traveling to a different match that might not be at your home range or near your area.
Okay. So we know we don't need a passport. So it's obviously not too difficult then to travel with your firearm or ammo.
Not at all. We fly Southwest there. I mean, that's how easy it is. Kathia, who runs that match, she is very on top of, like, once you register, you know, you fill out your permits, and it's really just asking. It's like your serial numbers, your ammo, and then it's just like you just put if it's like hand load or like what brand. You don't even have to put how much. And then our bags came off on the carousel, so we just grabbed them. And other countries, sometimes you have to keep your firearms at the range. There you don't, so you can have them in your hotel or condo, and you know, then you can dry fire before the match, or kind of if something goes down, you can fix it, things like that, which is very nice.
All right. So it's almost like traveling for a major with the additional permit or paperwork that needs to be filled out.
Yep. It's very simple and very easy. And they keep you informed of anything that happens, whether it's starting times change, awards. I mean, they're on top of everything. You do get the shootout.
Okay.
Yeah. So I forgot about that.
And you went against JJ?
The first year, yes. I went. So I started, I don't remember who I started against, but I won that round. I won like two or three different rounds. I beat out Henning, I believe, as well. And then the final round was JJ. So it's all the rounds up to the last one are just single elimination. And then for the last one, it's best out of three. And so it was JJ and I, and the first round, JJ won. And I was like, oh, this is it. Like, there's no way I'm going to win, right? And then the second round, I happened to win. So then it's one against one. And then the final round, he beat me out by like two plates. And I was like, oh, that sucks. But it was still such a cool experience, because not often do you get to go head to head with a world champion or people like that, right? So it was really... I was very fortunate to make it to that point in that shoot off and have that experience.
Well, that's cool. So who did you shoot against this year?
This year I shot against Mason Lane, who I believe won the match. And
Yeah,
I had no chance on that one. It was just like, okay, I walk up, I shot, and then I was done. And that was it. But Justine was lucky enough to win the shoot-off completely this year. So I believe she went against Hunter first and beat Hunter. And then she went against, I believe, Mason or Nil. No, it was Nils. Beat Nils. And then she went against Juansik, which he was second in the shoot-off. So it was between Justine and Juansik. And then they went and she beat Juansik out for winning the shoot-off.
Wow. Some big names she's shooting against there.
I know. Good Lord. She posted a video. Just watching her shoot a steel array at that thing is just crazy. Like, I can't even track the dot that fast across steel. So
she's got millions of rounds down there through her guns. It's crazy.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Does Rifle World Shoot interfere with any nationals you plan on attending?
I don't believe it does. So the only nationals I'm planning on attending as of right now is Handgun Nationals, which is Limited Optics, and I'll be using the AO1 there as well, and then Carry Optics Nationals and IPSC. So those are the only three that I'm planning on. IPSC's in April, CO's in June, I believe, June. And then Rifle World Shoot, I believe, is in July or August, somewhere around there.
So what are your goals for – I don't want to use the word goals. I mean, you're a young guy. You've got so many different things going on right now that it's hard to say what those go or what will actually happen later. But where do you see yourself in practical shooting in 5 years?
So in practical shooting in 5 years, I've found that this community is just so great. And I've been so fortunate to be able to be a part of it, whether it's from my parents for supporting me to do it and my sponsors, and just everyone in the community has always been super helpful. I'm planning on sticking around in practical shooting for as long as I see, and always just doing it and going to the big matches and just shooting and having a fun time. And I think that's something that a lot of people, they kind of get down on themselves. I see a lot of like, oh, I didn't do that well at this match or whatever. Like, I didn't perform to the best of my abilities. And it's like, yeah, that happens, but just always have fun. Like, at the end of the day, you started shooting competitively because you thought it was awesome and fun, and just trying to kind of keep a positive attitude throughout all those matches and just kind of make sure everyone else is having a good time.
So any aspirations to be a world or national champion?
Yes, definitely. I would say for Carry Optics is my main division. I definitely want to try. I would say this year, top 30 is my goal. I'd say it's probably doable depending on how much I get to practice with that. And then for Rifle World Shoot, I don't really have any expectations set yet for that, just because I got to get some time behind the gun and I've never been to a world shoot before, so I don't really know what to expect yet. But I'll definitely, you know, set some personal goals for that as well. And then for IPSC Nationals, I'm hoping to win junior again, because I believe the age limit is still 21. So if I can become the national champion for production optics at IPSC Nationals again, that would be great, because I did that last year in Florida when I was there.
Are you staying in? All right. So at some point, they're going to have to do something with limited optics and carry optics.
Yes.
So if they change carry optics to 15 round mag capacity, are you staying there or are you going to move over to limited?
I would stay in carry optics. I think that I would actually almost like it if they went to that 15 round thing, just to kind of make it similar to IPSC, because I feel like setting your gear up for IPSC Nationals versus like CO Nationals, like, it's almost two completely different divisions, even though it's practically the same gun, right? Because in IPSC, you can't run base pads if they're over a certain weight. So I'm left with the stock ones and then 15 round mags. And so finding a way to either make those similar or have IPSC merge with carry optics would be awesome. So I would go, instead of limited optics, I would go to carry optics.
But I would assume then you would still shoot limited optics when you weren't shooting carry optics.
Yeah, I've shot maybe 4 or 5 matches in limited optics. I find it super fun. Adding a magwell to a carry optics gun is just a blast, just because you already have to practice your reload so much that the magwell doesn't really make that big of a difference, because you're so used to having to actually, you know, look at the magwell and seat that mag. So it's just a blast. And being able to start single action only instead of double action, I don't do, actually. I still do double action. It's just such a habit. I can't not put the hammer down. Like, okay. I know when I shot single stack, I found myself, I'm like, wait, no, I don't have to put the hammer down. Just pick the safety on, holster it, you know. But the next division I think that I'm going to try and tackle is going to be open. And that's actually something that I'm really excited about, is CZ Custom recently made, I have it right here, I've been shooting it a little bit. It's the AO1 open gun. So it's based off of their AO1 platform, but it has their same barrel and they put a comp on it as well. And the cool thing about this is the comp is actually made with the barrel. So it's a blank and then they drill it out for the port. So it's not threaded on. So you retain a lot better, like, one, velocity, and it's, you don't have to worry about it ever like coming off. Cause I know at the Checkmate, that was a thing, because the comp was threaded on and then it aligned with the guide rod. So every time you shot, the guide rod would go into the comp to recenter it. So this takes away a lot of that variability. And being on the AO1 platform, you get that P10 mag, which has that increased reliability. And I know that was a big problem with the Checkmates having unreliable mags that I've seen people go down. And so to combat that, CZ Custom has actually made a 28 round 170 millimeter P10 mag that fits the gauge. So
no,
now
they
you
did
have,
not.
So now you have a actual CZ open gun that will run. And so I only have about 1,000 rounds of 9 major through this, but we'll bump those numbers up after carry optics and world shoot and be dabbling in open a little bit. So
wow. And that looks like you've got a 507 comp on that one too.
I do, yes.
Okay. Yep, so I like the uniformity.
I know.
That's good.
You gotta stick with what you know. And then I have a 507 comp on my Ace gun as well for virtual reality. Just running the same thing.
There you go. Perfect. Mm-hmm. Well, Carson, that's what I had for you. Was there anything we didn't talk about that you wanted to?
No, I believe we covered everything. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you coming on. It's been a wonderful conversation, and we'll have to, if you're up for it, after Rifle World Shoot, we'll have you back on and we'll talk more rifle.
Yes, definitely. I'd love to. I think after Rifle World Shoot, I'll have a bunch more knowledge about something new that I'd love to talk about.
Until next time.
Don't be a little bitch.
Yeah.